How many Lucha references can I get into this episode? Welcome back to Motorsport 101. The correct answer here is 2. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 624 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us for another doubleheader recording here at Motorsport 101. And just when you thought the world championship was frilling up and getting towards what we thought was going to be a three-way fight, we've now got a brand new odds-on favorite. And his name is Lando Norris. For the first time in 17 rounds, the Brit leads the Formula One world championship by just 1 point. And he did it with, well, arguably the best F1 weekend he's ever had at the Autodromo Hermanos Rodriguez over in Mexico City. And what was a surprisingly quite good Mexican Grand Prix. I pretty much enjoyed that one. Good start, good finish, bit of chaos, bit of strategy. What's not to enjoy? We'll also get the opinions of our usual esteemed guests. First up, Mr. RJ O'Connell. How's it going, mate?
I believe this is El Grande Americano. please address me by my proper luchador name.
El Grande. So which one of the four different versions of you are you specifically?
The one that has, like, I don't know, turned that shitty gimmick around into something that's, like, actually palatable. Let's turn it over to El Grande Americano number 2.
You're just going to have to beep all of that out now, aren't you? Good job. That's you giving out your own editing tasks for the show.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about. There's no way I'm going to delete this later. It's far too good.
How about them rookies? How about them rookies in FP1, dog? We had
9 of them.
All of them.
Like, we had so many in there. We was Ayumu Iwasa. We had Antonio Fuoco make his Formula One debut. Pato was out there for a traditional pop the home fans sort of run, go home dark match, whatever you want to call it. It was crazy. So, like, I don't know why Mexico has become like the rookie test weekend race now all of a sudden, but it's
because FP1, you gotta burn one at some point, and FP1 here is useless without Dusty. This track gets
dust everywhere, like, yeah, dust and the Forza Horizon 5 sepia filter.
Oh, cool, we can tell it's in Mexico.
Yeah, just in case you weren't sure by the architecture,
you can tell
the
landscape. It's a shitter version of the game that came before it.
Yeah, that's also now available on PS5, as Emma puts in the chat, which makes me die.
Okay, I don't know if that's if Forza Horizon's coming to PS5, but we know Halo is, and that's weird.
Forza Horizon already came to PS5.
It's been out for months, dude. My man.
Dude, bro.
You're watching Microsoft's Xbox division go the way of Sega circa 2002. Which is to say, at some point in the next 4 years, we're going to have a Halo game which involves severe, severe glitches.
I owned an Xbox 360. Dre owned an Xbox 360.
I did.
That console was putting out nothing but hits for the longest fucking time.
One of the greats.
Then what happened?
With
the power of Kinect.
Step one, sharing the game.
Microsoft spent years getting confused, thinking people wanted an entertainment device when it was just a fucking games console. That's what happened. And everything can circle back to essentially forgetting that you're meant to make great games first. Instead, you want to be the all-round entertainment device that nobody asked or wanted for.
Well, Speaking of great games, do we want to talk about the adventures of our friend Jalopnik's own Ryan Eric King? Or should we leave that for another time?
I think for his sake, we should probably leave that one alone.
Oh, yeah. it's a good one.
I think I'm just gonna grab my drink and walk away.
Yeah,
I think I'm gonna grab a slice of some affordable, like, $5 pizza, and then come back and we can talk about it later. But we got an F1 race to talk about. So, Dre, why don't you tell us about all the places we can find us? If this is your first time listening, or your second or tenth.
King, if you're listening to this, let the record show I had nothing to do with the last 30 seconds of what you may or may not have just heard. Yeah. Places you can find us real quick are on youtube.com/motorsport101 or on facebook.com/motorsport101. I'm almost going here. We're on Twitter, motorsport_101. And if you want to follow us personally, you can on Blue Sky at Dre Harrison, RJ O'Connell, and CBuckley917 on bsky.social. If you want to get some video highlights of the show, you can at motorsport101pod on Instagram and M101_podcast on TikTok. You can follow us on there. So you guys get some bonus videos from me as well, because I was feeling extra talkative about penalties and what have you. So if you want to check that out, you can on TikTok, M101_podcast. Yes, it's me over there admining that, and that's a fun time. All of the details, of course, are on our website, motorsport101.com, including written reviews of both this race and some extra words on the pretty grim situation that happened at Sepang this past weekend. We'll be talking about that, obviously, in much more detail in our next episode. But if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our written content and audio content, and you can upgrade to the $10 tier to actually listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Raptor is, as Ghost Raptor is doing right now, Jason is doing so as well. Thank you very much. And Emma's here as well, actually. I forgot to mention Emma as well a minute ago. So thanks everybody for joining, listening to the show, and supporting as ever. Right, without further ado, I'm going to go grab a drink, and then we're going to talk about the 2025 Mexican Grand Prix.
Well, everybody, this Dre mentioned it. This was Lando Norris's best weekend in Formula One, arguably his best. He gave the field the pinata treatment at Autodromo de Manos Rodriguez in Mexico City. He dominated the weekend, qualifying on pole by 0.4 of a second at the high altitude. He weathered the early storm with chaos ensued in the opening lap. We'll talk about that later, but Norris pulled away from the Ferraris and was not seen again for the rest of the race. He eventually won, only missing out on the Grand Slam by a fastest lap. He won it by 30 seconds, the biggest margin of the calendar season. Behind him, we were going to have a hard-charging battle for the podium as Max Verstappen on soft tires closed in an 11-second deficit to Charles Leclerc. Probably just going to make that pass for second, but we had a virtual safety car on the penultimate lap for Carlos Sainz's stranded car in the stadium section. So no competitive finishes for second, no competitive finishes for fourth. And out of all this, Lando Norris now leads the championship by 1 point. But Dre, do you think he is really the odds on favorite to win the title?
I think he kind of has to be at this point. This is like, this was the most compelling Lando Norris weekend yet. And he'd be the first man to admit that the low grip situation at Mexico was what aided him most. He says he loves it on low grip tracks and low grip conditions. It suits him and his driving style and the McLaren that he has. This was the coming out party, but really, in my opinion, this has been the fifth weekend in a row that Lando Norris has been better than Oscar Piastri, and he's been chipping away and chipping away and chipping away at that gap. This was a big counterpunch, probably the biggest punch that Lando has landed since Australia on opening day. With Piastri down in fifth, this was a big swing, a 15-point swing. So just like that, he's now got a 1-point lead. He has the advantage. He's closing in on the number of race wins, so he might get the tiebreaker before the year's over as well. That could matter. That could very well end up being a critical factor by the time we get to the end of the season.
Oh, golly. And you mentioned it. Oscar Piastri started seventh, originally qualified eighth, moved up a spot with Carlos Sainz's grid penalty. Mm. And in that sense, you'd kind of feel like he was very fortunate to salvage a top five out of all this because, okay, we know he struggled at these low grip tracks at the end of last year, but am I wrong to think that there might not be something wrong with his car since Singapore?
I think a lot of people, I mean, again, this feeds into what we've talked about, I think, on earlier episodes, that a lot of Piastri fans want to now suddenly cite unfair treatment. And that's been the narrative that's been beaten into us for the last few weeks. where I think there's a much more obvious reason. Piastri has never gone well on this chunk of the calendar. Like, anyone who watched Formula One last season will tell you that besides Baku, which Piastri did have experience around from this time as a junior, because Baku has always been on the juniors for quite some time now, besides that, I think a lot of people forget that Piastri only has 66 career starts. That's not a huge number. And don't get me wrong, he has ticked every box you could tick as a Formula One driver to get to this point, that we're talking about him as a world championship contender in just his third season. But there was a bunch of rounds last year that Piastri was anonymous on. This was one of them. He was knocked out in Q1 here last year, and he could only manage eighth. Austin, he didn't go particularly well last year. Singapore, he was third, but he was way off Lando Norris when the actual race landed. So anyone who watched 2023 and 2024 should know that Piastri traditionally has not gone well here, but of course, with all of the heat that's gone in from the last 3-4 months of this Norris-Piastri title fight, thinking it was going to be a two-car race for the title, now it's 2.5, you could say, with Max, now clawing his way back into contention a little bit. I think that fan base is nervous, because deep down, they've seen this shit before, and it's a bad time to have a narrow lead with Lando Norris reeling him in.
Ask Oscar's manager for more on that.
You could kill the man, but not the idea. Go on, Cap.
Yes, you never want the end of the season that you're having to be described as 2010 Mark Webber. No one wants those problems. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I can't really add a whole lot. Oscar has been the one who's just been a little bit more anonymous. It hasn't all been bad since Zandvoort, but it's been more bad than good. He did do a great job of recovering to where he did. Arguably unlucky to not get one more spot out of someone who we'll mention in a little bit, because they had a day. But it's never a good day when your teammate is 42 seconds up the road. There is no context that makes that a good day. And now the other two have the problem of Lando having the hot hand of the two McLarens, and now he's ahead. Now he does have the points lead. So, in regards to Max running down the title fight,
he's now probably done.
He's maybe, this was the one he could afford to maybe drop, but now he's completely out of margin of error.
The more I think about it,
win.
The more I think about it, Cam, the more I think it's over. And the reason why is that, like you said, if I'm playing off what you said, because Lando has won, it means now that both McLarens have got a 35 and now 36 point advantage. So instead of having one McLaren maybe being able to have a bad day or having the bad results and what have you, now you need both McLarens to have errors, mistakes, and that just basically you've cut the already slim odds in half. Because there's not been very many outright howlers that McLaren have had all season. And that also includes asking Max to probably win everything left on the table. And there's one problem with that. No one has won 4 Grand Prix in a row this season. The best we've had is Piastri winning 3 early on at the start of the year. But no one's won 4 Grand Prix in a row in 2025. It's been too close and too competitive at the front for that all year long, with even George Russell interfering on occasion with Max's, you know, a handful of Max wins. But McLaren was won 13 Grand Prix this year. Chances are, if someone's going to win 4 straight, it's going to be someone in orange.
Maybe. But I guess now we'll know whether it's still on a little bit sooner. As a side note, yeah, this was probably Lando's best weekend. There was at no stage after lap one where I thought, yeah, he could lose this. He was gone.
I'm one of the people that always knew that this was in him. And I'm not some Lando Norris super fan. I just respond to all the people as they like, oh, he's not capable of this. He's always been capable of this. Like, did you not watch him when he was carrying McLaren for like the first 4 or 5 years of his career?
Well, the problem is that he was in prime position to do exactly this in Singapore last year, and he almost crouched straight out of a 22-second lead.
But it's that different tinge, now. It's
that
just
will
like
tinge you in some people's views.
It's always different now this year. It's just like how Oscar doesn't burn through his tires now, like he's in his rookie year now. He's got other things to deal with, like getting a handle on low grip surfaces. It's the same with Lando. It's the same for Mats, really. And if I'm Oscar, like I can at least take solace that like Sao Paulo's next. That's not a low grip track. He really needs to bounce back at that event.
He needs to win. Ideally,
he has no choice.
If you're Piastri, you now probably have to win 3 out of the last 4 to make absolutely sure of it. Anything less and you open the door for Lando. Especially if what we think about Vegas is going to be true and we all think George is walking into that as favorite.
Well, especially when... how did Brazil go last year?
Well, it rained, and then Max opened a keg on the entire field.
What's predicted for this weekend at Brazil?
Rain.
All 3 days.
Oh, Christ.
With thunderstorms on Saturday. Interesting.
Oh, boy. That could be messy. How's that Red Bull in the wet? Because we've not had very many examples all season long. Really, we only had rain when? Australia?
Fast, and then it chewed up the tires, but I think that's pretty emphatically fixed on the Red Bull, given about 4 races ago.
Yeah. Exactly. We saw it, Australia, Max was trading blows with Max, also with Lando pretty much the whole way through, so the pace is there. And we all know Max is incredible in the wet, generally speaking. Yeah. Just on raw skill, he's right up there with anyone I've seen in the wet in recent times. I still think... If I was a bookie and I had to price it up, I think Max is now probably at something like 12-1. He needs a lot of help from here. So, even if he wins all 4,
He needs a little bit of help.
He needs extra help. As I've said before, he's in the snooker's required phase. And for those of you who know you snooker, you will know that the other guy you're playing across the table is Mark Selby. Good luck. James mentioned that to me on Twitter, and I promised I would get that in the episode. So you're welcome, James. I know you're listening. hope you appreciate that one. But it doesn't take away from the fact that, look, I'll give Max this. He was a bit rough around the edges early on. I mean, that start was a bit on the reckless side. But given he was quite despondent after qualifying on the third row on Saturday, the fact he was able to run a comfortable third, even with the mess, and really should have finished in second, that soft tyre stint at the end of the race, he was the only front runner to do the medium soft. He did the reverse strategy. 30 consecutive laps in the 121s, and where only Norris was quicker. Sensational
stint. Beyond that. Right, that the soft tire stint was impressive. I talked to some people on socials. The medium tire stint, keeping pace with the soft runners until probably the last 7 or 8 laps of that stint, when the medium was junk this weekend. Every other tire but the soft was not a viable tire. I don't know why Williams hates Alex Albon. I don't know why, but they put that man on hard tires just to suffer.
He is God's strongest soldier when it comes to tire preservation runs, because they put that man on the hard going into the weekend when Pirelli reckoned the hard, the C, because those who don't know, Pirelli skipped a compound again this weekend, so they went C2, 4, 5. The hard was the C2 tire rather than the C3, and Mario Isola, who was the head of Pirelli, said
tungsten.
He said, yeah, you might as well have been driving a cinder block because it was 2 seconds a lap slower than the soft tire, they reckoned.
Yeah.
2 seconds.
They actually had the problem here. Well, the problem is that every tire but the soft, you would slide around, overheat the surface, and destroy it anyway. So they weren't actually any more durable than the softs. Max takes the reverse strategy. I don't know how he kept it out of the wall at turn one when he went off, because he was full opposite lock on the grass for about a second.
We've got to talk about that start because, I mean, one of the funny things about Mexico is it's the longest turn one run on the calendar now. Now we no longer go to Sochi. It's 700, I think it's 760 meters to turn one. It's 3/4 of a kilometer. Max, as usual, got a really good start from row three. And next thing you know, we're going four wide into turn one. And turn one is a 90-degree corner. No, that's not going to work. No one backed out of it. And we saw Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen cut across the grass to get back online at the end of turn three, which led to all sorts of carnage. Leclerc was briefly leading. He gives up his lead to Lando Norris again. Max gives up two spots, so he ends up behind Hamilton again.
Not the only car that Charles passed off track, as we found out in the day after.
Yeah. It was a bit cheeky on that one. No punishment was given for any of this, by the way. Stewards were like,
the thing is on the Max side, like, right, Max comes out, he gains position, he immediately cedes both positions that he gained. So he went into the corner, fourth, and he gives it back up to come back to fourth. George Russell was extremely mad about this, he who was never anywhere near this, because he chose life.
There's a great clip on socials of George's onboard through that first lap, and he just sees cars flying in every direction. It's great.
He lifts about another 30 meters before everyone else, because, like, I want no part of this.
He was singing the old Italian job theme of this, the self-preservation society, because he wanted no part of that beef. None whatsoever.
All the beef for him was on the radio. Charles Leclerc did not cede all the positions that he received off the track. Nor did he necessarily need to go off the track. He had caught the car and was like, well, might as well. Max is doing it.
Well, I'm here, innit? I'm here now, innit?
I love that man, but he is a silly, silly boy.
Got away with it.
Yeah, he got away. He got a second out of it. Because he was able to build a gap and was not quite caught before the VSC at the very end of the race. Lewis Hamilton fans are both way too online, but also kind of right about being pissed about this.
Because he was the only one that got a penalty for leaving the track and gaining an advantage. Well, how did he leave the track?
Well, in the case
of... Fisticuffs?
Yeah, he and Max got into it again early on.
First to the apex and all.
Yes, Max dives it in at turn one, gets enough of his car alongside that by our famous rules of engagement, he is entitled to space. He keeps two wheels on track. Lewis goes off the track a little bit. Max is technically ahead going into the next turn. Lewis shoves him off. Max rejoins. Next corner, Lewis locks up, goes flying off the road, rejoins ahead of everyone. Does not take the correct line back onto the track. The bicycle path that would be far too narrow, even for a MotoGP long lap penalty.
Didn't it clear him for that, but the penalty was for leaving the track and gaining an advantage?
He did not give up the time gain, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. To clarify, he wasn't dinged for not taking the escape road. He was given a bit of a pass for that one. He was dinged for leaving the track and gaining a lasting advantage because, as Cam said, he did not give up the extra time or positions he gained from taking the grassy path in the first place. And by the letter of the law, it's now a 10-second time penalty for a driver-based infraction, and there was no mitigation. So... like,
yep, the turkeys voted for Thanksgiving and
I know a lot of Hamilton fans got really pissy about this. It's a slam dunk penalty. Ferrari should, like, if Hamilton didn't realize this himself, which he really should have, he should have at least had someone at the team say, we need you to drop a position here. Like, just out of sporting. Like, Lewis has had nearly 400 Grand Prix. He knows when he's gained by cutting a corner. You're like, come on now. Like, it's there's no excuse. But, you know,
The same bum rushing the apex that we've seen plenty of this year, because the drivers voted to keep this around when they could have abolished it. And, well, now Max is using those rules of engagement against people again.
Let me say on the record, I don't like the way that this played out. I don't like the fact that Max was able to bull rush the apex, basically have contact with Lewis's car and get away with it because he did have he was alongside Hamilton's wing mirror, that is enough for you to have the right of way on that corner. I just think it makes a mockery of generic racecraft. I think it's stupid. I think it's not even the most egregious one of this year. I still think that was when Carlos Sainz tried to dive around the outside at Monza into turn four.
Yes.
And because, like, he goes around the outside, but because he's got a wheel at the wing mirror, he's entitled to space, and then spins out and clatters the guy on the inside. It's so stupid. You're just rewarding people that break late.
It looks cool, isn't it?
Last of the late breakers and all, etc.
Looks cool, in it. Russell, probably.
It's stupid. We've talked about this many, many times this year, that this rule is not practical. It was a selfishly made rule, with the driver's own dicks being at the front and foremost of what they were thinking. They had a chance to ban this after Austin 2024. They could have said, this is not how we want to race. Instead, the attitude was, why can't we do that? Because these drivers are inherently selfish.
Double down.
Yeah, if only the president of the GPDA, as one of the three directors there, wasn't, you know, so max-pilled he didn't have his own agenda to want to try and replicate some of Max's own tactics by being able to use them against him, like he tried in Austin in the sprint race a couple of weeks ago. Hey, I ain't forgotten about that one. Ironically, the only reason it didn't work was because George locked up at the apex.
Control of his own car.
That's the asterisk. It's the second time he's done that this season. He did it in Catalonia as well. And that's what I think partially led to Max hitting him. And part of the meltdown was the fact that they thought that George's pass was legal when it wasn't, because he lost control of the apex. So there was never going to be a penalty coming or anything along those lines, because George lost control. It's crazy.
So out of all that early skirmish, we had a race of two Ferraris. Hamilton sinks down the order to eighth, largely because of the penalty, while Charles Leclerc gets to enjoy a hard-earned second-place finish. And George Russell spends a lot of the second half of the race just having not quite a Kurt Busch radio sweetheart-level meltdown of the radio when dealing with Kimi Antonelli.
I'm not Jimmy Spencer with the cigar in my hand.
I think the best one of that was, quote, I've got a fucking McLaren up my fucking ass. I can't look after this car, etc.
No. My favorite one, Piastri finally gets him, and Kimi was watching it a few seconds back. He's like, so now can we swap positions again?
Oh, that was good.
I love that kid.
That was great. This was just great content. And honestly, the only thing missing at the end of George saying I've got a McLaren on my ass is somebody shouting park life in the background. that would have just topped it off perfectly, quite frankly.
It would have probably worked out for Mercedes were it not for the fact that in the heat, in the high altitude, pit stop equipment tends to not quite work right up here. And Kimi Antonelli, who was basically being used as a meat shield for Russell after the swap to get towed around in DRS, had a 4.5-second pit stop, and that was the end of that.
To be fair to George, and I will give him this, I can understand why he was a bit stressed about it, given I think he was right to believe that inaction was not going to lead to anything good for Mercedes in that current situation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I can understand why he spoke out so passionately, shall we say, about his current situation.
Vociferously.
But I also think that George didn't have the pace that he thought he did once he was actually in open air, because he was stopped by the great wall of, and the man we didn't think we'd be talking about in this manner this weekend, Oliver fucking Bearman.
Mercedes just lost to the gritty Haas.
The joint best result in Haas F1 team history. One position away from that long-awaited maiden podium. And for a guy who has had a rookie year of ups and downs, the downs being he's had a bunch of very silly driving infractions, and the ups has been he's handled
right on the edge of a race ban.
Yep, and the ups being, like, He has measured up well against Esteban Ocon, a respected veteran, a Grand Prix winner, and multi-time podium finisher in the same team.
Yeah.
This is good.
He was...
People forget that, like, everybody was making the deal about Antonelli's the prospect of the future. But, like, if Antonelli's the number one pick in this draft, Behrman's a close two.
Remember, even Michael Jordan wasn't a number one pick. Look, like, Behrman
was... a number two pick.
No, he wasn't. That's the scarier thing. Yeah, like, Behrman was like the fly on the wall while Max and Lewis were just beating the shit out of each other. And he was able to slot into position behind that whole mess.
Uh-huh.
And once released into open air, he just went out there and ran laps.
His pace was great.
The only person who could run him down from behind was Piastri. And because of the VSC at the end, couldn't get there to make a move on him.
I think even without the VSC, I think he still ends up finishing fourth. Once Piastri got into that 1.5 second, as Cam would say, scum air zone.
Oh, it was scummy this weekend. This track would go so hard if it was at sea level.
High altitude dirty air is the great equalizer. Mm-hmm. High altitude dirty air doesn't care who you are, or where you are, or what you're doing. It's coming.
That's what makes it
so dangerous.
Remember Lewis going berserk on the radio? It was like, I think it was the first time we came back here, 2015, because he was behind Rosberg that whole race, and he just could never get closer than like 1.3 seconds.
Yeah.
That's just how cars are up here.
Yeah, the thin air, the dirty air, all the medium speed corners, the low speeds, final sector. It's all designed to not be able to follow somebody else around it. It's a really nasty track in these sorts of cars, and that didn't stop Oddie Behrman. Like I said, he qualified really well. He made Q3. He was opportunistic when there was the chaos going on around him of a bunch of other big hitters making mistakes, locking up, taking escape roads, you name it. He took advantage, put himself in the right place, was brave, bold, and then once he was in open air, which he was had the luxury of being in for most of the race, he made him pay. And also, Cam alluded to this a minute ago about how pit equipment doesn't work when you're a mile above sea level. Haas pulled out its best pit stop of the year on that second stop to get Behrman out in front of Antonelli at a 2.3 second stop, which normally we wouldn't normally jump up and down about a 2.3 second stop. But as Oddie Behrman admitted after the race was over, Haas don't have top line equipment.
Of the teams here, they're very much still the minnow.
They are using hand-me-down old equipment to use their pit stops with. And they you've got to remember, Haas have less than 300 people working within this team. They are by a country mile the smallest team on the grid. And it's not like an Audi, which are about to expand massively. Now they're about to take over this team. And Audi already announced earlier this year they're building a new UK base on top of what we've already got in Hinwil as well.
Haas's expansion has been restructuring on the inside and then contracting out to Toyota, with Toyota not needing to use all of their facilities because, well, we're not bringing new aero kits every three races in LMP1 cars anymore.
Yes.
Those days are long, long, long gone.
Indeed.
So Haas, for them to achieve that, and again, what's been a relatively down year compared to last year where they look like giant killers, this year's been a little bit... Not old Haas, because old Haas had really, really down times. But this is a little bit more like your traditional midfield team. Some up, some down. This was a very up day.
It's been such a bloodbath in the bottom half of the table. Again, we talked about this before. Alpine, the best, worst team in Formula One history with 20 points on the year.
Hey, Dre, at least they didn't commit team orders for 16th place this weekend.
No, they were just generically terrible instead this weekend.
Yeah, And now that investment group with all the celebrities and bought into the team wants to sell its share.
Yeah, great investment, you guys. At least we had Travis Kelce wear a hat on a podcast. Great job, everybody.
They got two podiums in one race.
Yeah, and look, let's put it to you this way. Haas have had their best season in Formula One, I want to say, for a good 6 years. They have 62 points on the season. They are in 8th place. Kick Sauber has 60 points on the year. They're in 9th. That is outrageous that the convergence of scoring and the way it's played out this year, that Kick Sauber that has a podium finish, multiple top fives, they've been in the points a dozen times this year, are then somehow the 9th best team in Formula One right now, despite having a driver who's 9th in the championships, and Gabriel Bortoleto, who, by the way, has 19 points this season, is 19th in the driver standings. How did that happen?
Like, the standings are just so high.
The only other even partial full-timer we've had that's below him is Franco Colapinto, who was unlucky to have not scored points in Zandvoort when he was 11th, and Alpine is the clear bottom-rung car right now, alongside Jack Doohan.
For years, like, if the worst driver in Formula 1 these days is, like, I don't know, Lance Stroll, Franco Colapinto, Yuki Tsunoda, etc., that 20th best driver on the grid now is way better than the worst drivers of grids on anything from our childhood and the childhoods of our parents.
It's never been better.
Tsunoda could have had 8th place in this race and had a fucking 12-second pit stop.
I don't want to talk about it. Want to talk about it.
Look, going back to my earlier statement, 42 seconds off your teammate is never good. Unfortunately, it's par for the course at this point if your teammate is Max Verstappen. But geez, he doesn't need the help.
Look, if there's one solace you could take from Yuki Tsunoda, Red Bull has pretty much unofficially said they're delaying their decision as to what to do with their drivers. They've always said they're going to make it.
Mekhi's been openly defending him in the media.
Yeah, like, and don't get me wrong, part of that is that Mekhi's has always liked Yuki Tsunoda. He's always batted for him from his time when he was Racing Bull's team principal. But Helmut Marko had always said they were going to decide after Mexico what they were going to do about next year. They've now apparently delayed that decision. That has got to be an indication to me that they're not so sure about Yuki yet. Because if they were so sure about him, they would have announced that they were going to move him on already. They clearly haven't, and I think Yuki's improvement over the last 3 or 4 weekends has been enough to have Red Bull second-guess themselves, because I think Hadj has gone off the board a little bit, and I think Yuki's been a little bit better. And I think...
Yeah, and Lawson's race functionally spent about... it lasted the first straight.
But he was whacked by Carlos Sainz, wasn't he? It was the other track excursion we didn't talk about.
Carlos Sainz had the Kramer-Seinfeld side plot of this race. Yes, he's the only person who can understand the soup Nazi.
Well, I mean, we did see that Laugh Factory victory video.
Oh, we did.
Yes, Carlos Sainz, 5-place grid penalty to start with for his ambitious overtake last race.
Mm.
And then clipped on turn one. And then damage to the car. He pits relatively early. He speeds in the pit lane because he has a sensor problem. Then he speeds in the pit lane again because he has a sensor problem.
Uh-huh.
And then he spins and retires from the race.
Which gets us to one of the more heated flashpoints after the race besides, like, I don't know, the Ferrari Civil War, the 33s and 44s going out again. It's the decision to throw the virtual safety car with the car, like, pretty well off the track. That in isolation seems like overkill, but you have to remember that at the start of the race, there were marshals on track picking up debris. Liam Lawson almost hit him.
Yeah, for full context, there was obviously debris on track at turn one after the initial opening lap contact. They were going to have the marshals collect the debris on the bottom end of the straight once everybody had gone through that corner again, because obviously they're all bunched up, so you've got a good window of time to have a marshal run out to the track and be able to collect it safely. The problem with that was that Liam Lawson had come into the pits on the end of lap one with the car damage that he'd suffered, so he was technically off sequence. The FIA realized this. They cancelled that request, and then they put out a double yellow in that zone instead to say, listen, there's debris on track. You know, double yellow, slow down, be prepared to stop. Again, I don't know for sure because the FIA is still investigating this as we speak as to what happened. It seems to me, the impression that I get is that it's a miscommunication because two marshals ran out onto the track anyway to collect the debris, despite the request being cancelled to collect it, and then Liam Lawson nearly hit them. Terrifying to watch in real time. Obviously completely unacceptable and just flat out ridiculously dangerous. We're very lucky that no tragedy came upon either of these marshals or Lawson himself. Obviously something clearly went wrong in the communication here. I don't think it's from the FIA's end. It's if what they're saying on their end is true, then they noticed what was going on with Lawson and was like, no, don't do it. You know, we've got double yellows in this area, but
yeah,
we'll exactly. know more soon because they're investigating it right now.
But with Sainz's car, like being so far out of the way, it was just like, did this need such a long VSC? And Sainz found an outlet to pull his car into as well. Like he did the right thing.
It's a weird one for me because it's, again, the lack of this show being a visual medium is a bit tricky, but he was on the barricade on the inside of the stadium section past the penultimate corner complex, the blue part of the Astro.
He spun on the final corner of the complex and clipped the wall, broke the right rear corner. He basically spins the car and drags it out behind the barrier himself.
It's kind of half in, half out, and look, in people's defense here, looking back on it, it's on a part of the track where no one realistically is going to hit it. Like, it would be a walking miracle if somebody hits that stranded car. Like,
someone
would have to drive there. Someone would have to drive there deliberately.
Yeah, exactly. Like if that person, I'd have to ask for their Powerball numbers if that were to ever actually happen. However, what ended this discussion was the car caught fire. And that is a VSC.
Yeah.
Like, because you have to have people. You have to have them because the car was half sticking out. It's on fire. You need personnel on the track to put the fire out. So that was what led to the VSC and effectively the end of the race. That is no argument from me whatsoever. If a car's on fire, no shit, you put that out.
You know what that is? That's one of them racing deals.
It's unfortunate.
It is one of them racing deals.
It's unfortunate. The FIA made that same explanation. Yeah, there was a fire signal coming from the car. And that's why we pulled the VSC to get people on the track to be able to put the fire out safely. No argument from me. Case closed.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I'm never going to sit here and say, no, let the car burn. We've got to get this final lap in first.
Like, I don't know, the way Sainz's race went, he might have wanted to let that car burn.
But what it's a like race.
Only if he's looking back at it dramatically, like that one photo of his car burning from Austria.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. I still
love Kovalainen's tweet about the 2010 Lotus. Should have let it burn. Car was not very good.
While wearing an Angry Birds helmet. As you do.
God, that is 2010 pilled.
That is so 2010. That was 15 years ago now. Almost to the month.
All it needs is in the background a PS3 poster that says it only does everything.
Oh, doesn't that bring it all full circle? Yeah, I'm bummed that we didn't get to see the Leclerc Verstappen duel that we wanted. The Behrman Piastri duel. Could Behrman have held on? Could Piastri have gotten those 2 points? We'll never know. It's one of those shitty deals, but you'd probably rather have that stoppage too early than too late, as Dre would say.
Absolutely.
From the days of when MMA was just a mildly unhinged sport.
Yes, the sport that now complains more about the someone who's the victim of the eye poke rather than the person that gave one. Tom Aspinall joke. There you go. We've come full circle on this podcast today. But it's overall pretty good pretty race. Good. Probably the best Mexican Grand Prix I can remember, because Mexico,
generally is a bit shit. Usually doesn't produce bangers.
No.
It produces bangers in Le Mans prototypes. It does not produce bangers in open-wheel dirty air machines.
Mm-hmm.
What really set this one off is kind of mid-race, people realized just how bad the medium was, and you couldn't go anywhere with it, and they started ditching them for softs.
In a weird sense, it was kind of mission accomplished for Pirelli by taking the hard tire out of the equation, because the medium tire ended up being so shit, it kind of did its intention.
You're going to make a tire so bad, you're going to want to do an extra stop just to get off of it.
Yeah, and what we got was actually an excellent 1/2-stop race where strategies converged and we got some drama. So it actually turned out to be quite a good Grand Prix in that sense. So Pirelli, I think by complete accident, got it right.
Task failed successfully.
Excellent. It's Apollo 13 all over again, where they called it a successful failure.
Well, we got to wait a week before we head down to Interlagos Circuit and what is officially the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, the Brazilian Grand Prix by any other name. Mm. Will the weather be a factor? If so, will it be so much of a factor that they can't race? If they do race, which I hope they will, what'll come of it?
It's going to be chaos. Brazil, look, there's an Ask Dre question in my inbox that said if you could only give 5 golden passes to all the MotoGP and F1 tracks on the calendar, which ones would you keep? Interlagos was one of them for me because it's an iconic round. And I know it's such an overused term nowadays, but it really is like one of the best F1 weekends on the calendar. Amazing fan base, always sold out. Unpredictable weather, tends to be a late season thriller in terms of drama. Like it's, I've said for years, it needs to be back as the finale. I know Abu Dhabi paid out the nose for that honor, but I personally will always be a Brazil should be the decider guy. We Brazil is done, and then we still have 3 races to go afterwards. Now I can't stand it that we have Qatar, Vegas, and Abu Dhabi after Brazil. Stupid.
Even last year, with how insane that was, nothing will ever compare to the sheer insanity of watching 2012 live. Nothing ever could.
2012 live, I mean, we did a watch-along of that very race on this show a few years ago. Go back and find it if you want to go out of your way to do so. But the drama of Vettel being spun round, Michael Schumacher's final race, the Hülkenberg versus McLaren fight that set the world on fire and Hülkenberg almost became a hero years before he ended up becoming so years later. Like I said, Vettel's comeback through the field, the team orders between Ferrari to try and get Alonso up the grid, all leading to a world championship that was decided by just 3 points in the end. An all-time classic. That's the sort of shit we get with Brazil. And hell, yes, a great weekend. Can't wait for, and it's a sprint weekend too. So that's going to be even more interesting because there's 33 points up for grabs that weekend, not 25. Still have 2 sprints to go, this and Qatar in November. So we can look forward to that. That's our next F1 race. It's a week and a half away on November the 9th. We'll be back then to talk about the Brazilian Grand Prix. Next time, we'll also be talking about MotoGP in Malaysia. Wish we could be as bright and as cheery about that one, but sadly, we can't. And you probably already know why. But we'll be talking about that on our next episode. But until then, I've been Dre Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Cam Buckley. Catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
I need that Hülkenberg payback win. That's what I need out of this year.